Have you ever wondered how artificial intelligence is helping solve medical problems? Or how medical research is making it easier to predict your genetic risks for disease? Hi, I'm Kathy Werzer. Tomorrow's Cure, a podcast from Mayo Clinic and PRX, is back for Season 2. Join me as I interview experts who are shaping the future of healthcare with groundbreaking advancements. What they describe may sound futuristic, but listen and you'll find out. Tomorrow's Cure is already here. Find it now wherever you get your podcasts.
When I think about some of the pizza commercials, when they add cheese to the dough, I'm like, really? Who really needs that? Who really needs that? But then once you taste it, you're like, I need it. I didn't know I did.
This is On Nutrition, a podcast from Mayo Clinic, where we dig into the latest nutrition trends and research to help you understand what's health and what's hype. I'm Tara Schmidt, a registered dietitian with Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. This episode, intermittent fasting. An eating pattern that involves taking breaks from food for certain periods of time. What are the actual benefits of this pattern? What's the best time to stop eating? And who should and shouldn't try it at all? There are multiple ways to fast intermittently, and that includes some wrong ways. So here to explain the line between health and harm is Dr. Maria Clausel-Clavel. Dr. Clausel-Clavel is a professor of medicine in Rochester, Minnesota, with a focus on obesity and diabetes. Thank you for being here today, Dr. Clausel-Clavel. It's so nice to see you.
Well, thank you for having me. And I must say, I'm really excited about this. I'm excited to see you as well.
I'm super excited to learn more about today's topic, which is intermittent fasting. This topic is everywhere with advice from everyone lately.
Yeah, like you said, this has been receiving so much attention recently, and there's so many studies out there. So I always have to give the disclosure that hopefully I won't oversimplify things, and that there may always be a study out there that's slightly different
exactly
than what I say. And really what I'm trying to do is do my best at reviewing the literature in a way that makes sense to people, and hopefully that's practical. So if they choose to make any one change in their eating habits, what's the most data out there to support that change at improving health?
This is exactly why I brought you on, so that you could do all of that work for me. Let's talk simply about definitions. So how do you describe intermittent fasting?
When most of my patients come into my office and they tell me I'm intermittent fasting, I actually try to ask specifically, what do they mean by that? Because if I'm trying to give them advice based on what I know from the literature, most of the studies have looked at actual fasting, where people have days where they consume very few calories, to more what we're calling time-restricted eating, which is only limiting eating to certain hours in the day. And that's the simplest distinction. However, even with fasting studies, there are some studies that look at fasting every other day, fasting two or three times a week. So there's a lot of variability. And when it comes to the time-restricted eating, limiting eating to certain hours a day, again, there are studies looking at 6 hours, 8 hours, 12 hours. So I'm really trying to get a sense of what is my patient doing? And based on the literature that's available, okay, what can I tell that patient regarding what's reasonable to achieve, whatever their goal would be, whether it's losing weight, whether it's just health or living longer. So what do we know about that?
Yeah. And that's actually a benefit to all of these different types, right? So I think of usually kind of three types: alternate day, right, which is where you fast every other day. Someone told me recently it's called eat, stop, eat, which I hadn't heard of yet. But okay, so we've got that one. 5-2 fasting. Now, is this the one where there are 2 days where you're under 500 calories?
Correct.
Typically, you know, over the course of a 7-day week?
It would have to be less than 500 calories, essentially.
And then, like you mentioned, time restricted. So we've got all of these different ratios, 16 to 8, 12 to 12, 10 to 14, whatever you want to do with 24 hours in a day, or even just one meal a day.
Yeah.
What do you think about the method of one meal a day?
Ideally, you want to have that earlier in the day. Often what I hear from people is they will have that large meal in the early afternoon because it's easy for them to fast the morning, and then they don't seem to get hungry. Some of these people go to bed at 8 p.m., so they go to bed early. So I think for the average person, one meal a day, as long as they're having their nutrients, shouldn't be a problem. I think with people with health conditions and medications, I would pay a little bit more attention because obviously some medications need to be taken with meals and sometimes they have to be more than once a day. It would probably be something that I would want to evaluate whether that's kind of wise.
Of all the different types of intermittent fasting, is there one approach you support the most?
Not any one, because like you mentioned earlier, you can find a study that, you know, is very convincing for any one approach. But I certainly do believe that our patients' input is really important as to what they feel confident that they can do. For example, if their goal is losing weight, I know in the back of my mind, you know, I have to pay attention to calories. Now, interesting enough, when the alternate day fasting studies were done, the eat, stop, eat, whatever. It's interesting because when people fasted and they consume less than 500 calories, the thought would be that they would compensate and overeat calories on the days that they were eating.
You're starving the next day and you go to town.
You overeat the next day. But actually, a couple of studies have shown that that doesn't really happen. So as a result, what happens is that people are consuming less calories and they may experience weight loss if that's their goal. Anecdotally, what I've heard from patients is that sometimes they just find it easy to just tell themselves, I'm just not going to eat today. And then it takes away that decision making of, okay, what am I going to eat? So if somebody can do that, great. If somebody like me, which at 10 in the morning, my stomach is growling so loud, that's probably may not work for me. Although there is an adjustment. The body does adjust, you know, when people fast.
Exactly. So what are some misconceptions or challenges when it comes to time-restricted eating?
Probably the biggest misconceptions with the time-restricted eating is that if you just limit eating to certain hours of the day, it doesn't really matter. You're going to lose weight. And a couple of studies have shown that really you do have to consume less calories in those hours to be able to lose weight.
So you're saying in this diet, you can only eat within very specific hours.
Yeah, it's really a way of limiting calorie intake. So what I found interesting is that some of the studies where their last meal is like at 3 p.m. or 4 p.m. might be quite strict. And when we think about life, you know, that's hard for people because they're working and by the time they get home. So I do talk to people about, okay, if you want to do a certain hours of eating, if you want to follow the time restricted eating, you know, what hours are best for you? The other question I ask is, okay, if you were to have a meal at 5 p.m., when do you go to bed? Because several studies suggest that after 4 hours, people will struggle with hunger. So if your first meal is at 5 and you typically stay up till midnight, you're going to struggle with hunger.
Because that's the time you'd normally have another meal.
Exactly. And then sometimes people, because we work during the day, find it easier to just not eat during the day and then get home and eat. And again, if they're consuming less calories, they may lose weight. But interesting enough, the benefits of fasting for a prolonged amount of time are not really seen if people consume most of their calories prior to bedtime. That actually doesn't benefit metabolically, blood sugar, blood pressure, as it would if you had your last meal, I would say at least 3 hours prior to going to bed, at least that.
Especially because when you're off to sleep, you don't need to do those things, right? You don't need to regulate your blood sugar as much. You don't need to kind of bring down all those things that we're used to, our bodies are kind of burning throughout the day.
Yeah. But it does do different things. You know, I mean, obviously when we ingest food, our physiology has to work on digesting that food and
break down
and
blood
break
sugar.
Down and store and this, that when we're fasting, our bodies take care of different things. So there's actually growing concern over the fact that in our current lifestyle, we have food available to us 24/7.
Yeah.
And actually a study looked at surveys of Americans said, we tend to eat for over 15 hours of our day. Might be a meal, might be a snack. So the thought is that that also contributes to weight gain, to diabetes, to all these metabolic things, or processes that affect our health.
You bring up a great point about our availability of food. I do believe that it's likely the piece of our obesogenic environment. And maybe it's not the intermittent fasting that was the weight loss. It was the fact that you didn't get your morning latte and that you skipped breakfast, or that you're not having wine and popcorn after 10 p.m. at night. And so I'll usually say to patients, it doesn't really matter what we want to call it, or if you want to have a certain ratio to it. Do you feel like this strategy is going to help you decrease your total calorie intake? And if it is, okay, let's go for it. But if you feel like you're going to compensate because you're starving now and it's 11 a.m. and you're going to have a giant lunch because you've been hungry since you woke up, well, that's probably not the best strategy for you. So I feel like there's a lot that complicates this practice.
It does. And, you know, and essentially says that I always say the principles are the same, but how we apply those mm-hmm. principles is different. And that's what's challenging, because for many people, they want to do the fasting, but then realize it's not for them. And then might feel like that's bad. Well, there's nothing bad about that. We just realize that's not for you. You know, what's the next approach? But you're right, that can introduce a lot of frustration. And my joke about the time-restricted eating is that I have a family member who would always talk to me about that. And I would say, well, just don't snack after dinner. You know, just don't snack. Never pay attention. So one day he comes to me, he goes, oh, this is working for me. I'm doing time-restricted eating. I'm not eating after 6 p.m. I'm like, you mean you're skipping your night times?
I've been telling you all these years.
I mean, it's the same thing. He just had a name to it, and now he could say, you know, and there's people talking about this, and it works. It's like, okay, that's fine.
Thanks a lot.
We'll call it time-restricted eating.
Intermittent fasting is a big lifestyle change, so it's important to have all the details before you decide whether it's right for you. Let's review the different types of intermittent fasting. There's 5-2 fasting, which involves eating regularly for 5 days a week and choosing 2 days to eat under 500 calories. Eat, stop, eat is a similar method, except you're fasting completely for 1 to 2 days out of the week. There's also time-restricted eating, the most common type, where you eat at your preferred ratio of fasting to eating hours. You could fast for 12 hours and eat the other 12, or fast for 16 hours and eat in the remaining 8, and so on. The schedule's up to you. And lastly, there's one meal a day, which is exactly what it sounds like. But since it's on the more extreme end of the spectrum, it's best to talk to your doctor first about whether starting is a good decision for you. And there is some strategy behind choosing your method of intermittent fasting. Be mindful of how many hours you intend to go without food before bed, but know that fasting for at least a few hours prior to sleep does come with some metabolic benefits. Now let's get into what the research says about intermittent fasting and who should and who shouldn't try this lifestyle. So let's talk about the physiology of intermittent fasting. What's happening to our bodies when we're restricting our eating?
We don't have as many studies on humans as we would like. So a lot of these studies or observations started out in animal studies. So for example, we have known for decades that if you restrict calories, whichever way you choose to do that, you will struggle less with weight management, diabetes, or heart disease, and you will tend to live longer. Initially, those studies were in rodents and mice. But interesting enough, about 20 years ago, some investigators noticed, well, you know, these rodents are getting their calories just in a 2-hour window, and they're fasting for 22 hours. So how much of it is actually the fasting? And that started some additional studies trying to separate how much is consuming less calories versus how much is the fasting. And again, you'll find some contradictory data. However, it is clear that fasting does provide benefits when it comes to your metabolism, when it comes to protecting you against heart disease, when it comes to protecting you against diabetes.
Speaking of the ease of studies in mice and rats, they're fed when they're fed. It's a lot easier to not eat if you don't have food in your little mouse food bowl than it is to sit next to your husband who's having ice cream while you're watching a show and also not eat. Like, that that doesn't sound that fun to me. I don't know if I want to do that.
Or calling
I'd make him
for
leave.
Somebody to deliver a latte to your home. it's like, oh my gosh. I will tell you that when I see commercials, the classic is pizza, and I enjoy pizza. But when I think about some of the pizza commercials, when they add cheese to the dough, I'm like, really? Who really needs that? Who really needs that? But then once you taste it, you're like, I need it. I didn't know I did. But, you know, there are all these subtle changes that make it harder for us to successfully limit calorie intake. And with that, what I tell my patients is make sure you make the choice. Not have somebody else make the choice for you as to what you should have. But it's hard. You know, when we go out to a meal, somebody else is deciding how that meal is prepared, how much they're serving us.
That's right. You're not going to go to happy hour or
Yeah. So you
dinner.
Have to make the choice. Okay, I'm going to do this. I mean, and it does take mental effort, which I do respect that.
Absolutely.
I mean, acknowledge that it, and people get tired. You know, it gets tiring.
We've talked about fasting in terms of 8 hours at a time, 12 hours, 16. At what point does someone who's fasting start reaping the benefits?
Yeah, you start seeing benefit when people fast for at least 12 hours.
Wow, okay.
And probably that benefit peaks around 14 hours or so, 14. And that has to do with mainly looking at metabolic health, meaning helping your body be efficient at handling sugars and fats. Because the first thing that's lost is how your body responds to insulin, this insulin resistance. Mm-hmm. And that starts the path to many other disorders that affect our well-being and challenge our lives. So it seems like 12 hours is probably the minimum. If your question is, okay, which 12 hours, you know, are the right ones?
Further away from bedtime is what I'm hearing.
Probably most people can get away with their first meal being mid-morning. Mm-hmm. And then 8, 9 at night. And then if you're going to bed by 11, that's within mm-hmm. that window. I might chat with patients about, you know, what's your routine like? Because I don't want to set up people to fail. I don't want to tell them something that right away they're going to think it's not going to work for them. But still be conscientious about what is it that we're hoping to achieve for their wellness and trying to use what we have available when it comes to data supporting that.
Yeah, I was just trying to think of my schedule. I was like counting up the hours of when I wanted to do
this. Yeah, I do this because I tell myself, you got to practice what you preach.
Is intermittent fasting safe? And are there any populations where it may not be?
Great question. For the average person that has no health conditions or is on no medications, I would say that it is pretty safe. So I really wouldn't have any concerns. The people in whom I would at least, you know, be aware is if people, for example, do have type 2 diabetes and they're on medications, that fasting might put them at risk for low blood sugar. Mm-hmm. That's something that can be easily managed, right? Talk to your doctor about this is what you're thinking about doing. You know, what is the impact of these medications? What should I be mindful for? When it comes to other health conditions, the only situation that I would be really concerned if is people have significant health issues with their kidneys or mm-hmm. their liver, which again, just being mindful of that and making sure that in our patient trying to do something good, they don't cost themselves so harm.
And I think some of the risks that may be listed in literature or online are actually just related to weight loss and especially rapid weight loss. They're not specific to intermittent fasting. So examples would be muscle loss, bone loss, dehydration, headaches. Those are not specific to intermittent fasting. Those are specific to someone losing weight. Do you agree with that?
You're right. Any weight loss, you do lose fat, but you do lose muscle and you do lose a little bit of bone. And actually, again, depending on somebody's age group, it's an important discussion. We know that, again, becoming more physically active not only will help you with the weight, but will help protect some of that loss of muscle that can occur. But yeah, sometimes people get really alarmed and it's true they happen. We wish we didn't lose muscle. But again, there are things that we can do to try to mitigate some of that negative effect.
Yeah, my patients, especially on the weight loss medications, who are losing it even faster than our patients doing it via lifestyle or intermittent fasting, we really preach strength training at them, and we really preach adequate protein, sometimes even higher protein diets, depending on their health history. But there's not a lot you can do other than maintain what you've got. And what you're going to do for that is enough protein intake. And you're going to challenge those muscles in whatever way you feel like doing it.
That's right. That's right.
How else have you seen patients' bodies react or adjust to this different pattern of eating?
Dietary change, especially when people are losing weight, you know, it can be challenging. So I hear different kind of complaints that have been well reported in the literature. You know, when people do the very low carbohydrate restrictions, some can have the classic keto flu, right? They don't feel well. They're kind of achy and they just can't adhere to it. We do know that when people are making changes and they're losing weight, so they're cutting back calories, the body adapts. And one of the adaptations is affecting those gut hormones that control appetite. So the way I explain this to my patients is like, you know, 6 months into a weight loss program, you might actually feel hungrier than you did in the beginning, even though you're doing the same thing. Or that meal that was satisfying a month into your weight loss program is no longer satisfying. 15, 20 years ago, we just blamed our patients. We just say, oh, you're just not disciplined. You can't. But now we understand that there are physiologic factors contributing to that, that our patients cannot consciously control.
The body fights weight loss and kind of promotes weight regain, which is so rude, right? Like if I've lost weight, like please keep it off. Is it appropriate for someone with a history of disordered eating to do intermittent fasting?
I would say that if somebody has had a prior diagnosis of maladaptive eating behaviors, I would want to get a sense of making sure that they're in remission, that they're not active. So one is getting a sense that they're well controlled and making sure that they have some support. Some things can trigger this back out of the blue. So I do encourage at least kind of setting up some type of support in case that happens, because we have no way of knowing if it's going to happen. What the literature shows is that if we actually start focusing a lot on weight loss when somebody's still participating in maladaptive eating behaviors like binging, they do not do well with their weight loss efforts. They actually keep gaining. They might lose a little bit, but then gain again. So it's just kind of getting the message that our goal here is to help them long term. So it might be that right now we're just working on stabilizing before we really focus on weight loss.
It's riskier to not talk about it than actually is to talk about it.
Yeah, I agree.
When you see the many studies about intermittent fasting, realize that most are based on subjects, including mice, who are restricting their eating but don't have other things to worry about, like a social life or work schedule. So make choices that are right for you and your lifestyle. We know that the most common benefits of intermittent fasting are weight loss and decreased risk of diabetes and heart disease. So how can you get those results? By eating during the daytime and fasting between 12 and 14 hours. Regardless of the time you eat when intermittent fasting, make sure to eat less calories overall during those windows and prioritize strength training and adequate protein. But who shouldn't try intermittent fasting? People with diabetes, liver or kidney issues, or history of maladaptive eating should be most cautious. And even if you don't have those diagnoses, it's a good idea to talk with a dietitian and a doctor for proper guidance. So at what point can intermittent fasting become unhealthy? And how do we adjust our lifestyle to make it work for us? What's the maximum amount of time you think someone could fast without consequences, let's say? And we're not talking about religious fasting, of course, but is more than 24 hours of fasting appropriate?
That's kind of a hard question, you know. But I would say for the average individual without health conditions, without medications, no major harm is going to come if they fast for like 2 days straight. Beyond that, if people become kind of really weak or dehydrated, I mean, you have to be mindful of many things. But if somebody tells me, well, I'm fasting for 48 hours a week, I want to go over, okay, why does that feel that's not easier for you?
Do you think that someone needs to check in with their physician if they intend to begin an intermittent fasting schedule?
You know, I think for the general person that's healthy without health conditions, not necessarily. I think it's always good to involve your doctor or medical professional in what you're doing to improve aspects of your health, because I would want to know. And potentially your doctor may be able to offer resources to help you out, whether it's literature, whether it's meeting with a dietitian. I view it as an opportunity. So I would say it's always good to share. Situations in which I would definitely bring it up, and again, the person with established health conditions, I would definitely go over medication list to make sure there's nothing that might worry me. There are some medications in the treatment of diabetes. These are the SGLT2 inhibitors that actually control blood sugar without insulin. They can run into significant problems. So if somebody has health conditions on medications, I think it would be important to bring it up to your doctor so they can go over your medication list, just kind of assess to make sure, okay, is there something that might worry me that we have to watch out for?
And you gave a shout out to dietitians, so thank you.
Yes,
because
yes.
I also need to make sure that you're able to get your nutrient needs met when you're fasting. So if you choose to only eat for 4 hours in a 24-hour period, it's going to be fairly difficult. How do I get you all your protein? And hydration can be outside of those hours, I suppose, if it's water. But how do I get you everything that you need? And do I need to cover your bases? So depending on the severity or maybe how strict you are with your intermittent fasting, you might need to involve more than one professional.
Yeah, I would agree. And even with some eating plans, like, you know, vegetarians, they might not be getting all their nutrients. So especially for, you know, again, young women, reproductive age, but often we might need to advise them to take a multivitamin, which the vast majority of people may not need. But I always tell patients when they start asking me questions about specific dietary things, like, I can give you the gestalt, but you need to see a dietitian because they will spend the time to go over those specifics, which I value.
Dr. Klausikelvel, do you happen to practice intermittent fasting?
Well, it's funny because I've done this kind of all my life. It was just noticing the benefits when it comes to metabolism. So I would tell you that in our household, we tend not to snack after our evening meal. Our evening meal is usually, you know, 6 or 7. We try to do that. I think 12 hours of fasting is good for health. And I do try to practice that.
And it doesn't always have to have a definition, right? So you may not go around saying that you practice intermittent fasting, but your household has a general rule or practice of not eating before bed. And that's okay too. So we don't always need to label.
We don't have to label it. Exactly. And especially for younger people, well, all of us, we're always trying to kind of adjust aspects of our lifestyle to situations, right? Mm-hmm. You know, when we're having young kids, there are all these different phases of life that impact these basic needs and how we adjust to that. But I like to encourage people to recognize that they do have some power of that. Is hard many times.
Adapting your environment is sometimes your best option.
But they do. They do have power over trying to facilitate the situation for them.
Dr. Klausikelvel, I want to thank you so much for your time today. I have always been learning from you my whole career, but I learned from you today. So thank you again.
Great. Well, congratulations with this and wishing you lots of success. Thank you for welcoming me.
Fasting is an extreme word, but there are ways to fast intermittently in a healthy way. First off, it's never a good idea to fast for more than 48 hours. And on the other end of the spectrum, it's okay to fall off the wagon. Remember, this is a totally optional eating pattern. And if any of these methods seem impractical for you, skipping ice cream after dinner is progress too. That's all for this episode, but if you've got a question or topic suggestion, you can leave us a voicemail at 507-538-6272. We might even feature your voice on the show. If you or a loved one is struggling with an eating disorder, you can find support through the National Eating Disorders Association at nationaleatingdisorders.org. For more On Nutrition episodes and resources, check us out online at mayoclinic.org/onnutrition. And if you found this show helpful, please subscribe and make sure to rate and review us on your podcast app. Thanks for listening. And until next time, eat well and be well.
This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as medical or legal advice. Always consult with a qualified healthcare provider for any medical questions. The appearance of any guest does not imply an endorsement of them, their employer, or any entity they represent. The views and opinions are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views of Mayo Clinic. Reference to any product, service, or entity does not constitute an endorsement of or recommendation by Mayo Clinic.